start our third session.
We are running 25 minutes late, but it was a lovely lunch, and I think it's human rights to lunch is very good and important. So this session looks into the transition to adulthood from an international perspective. For a series of international perspective, we are really delighted to have our panelists here, because they will bring both insights from other places around very similar issues, but also help us to think and rethink how to take our project forward, how to build links beyond the UK. We already do in a sense, because we have followed some of our participants, but we always try to engage also with place of the other place of destination, other place of origins, and so it's an important part of our work to be able to have this conversation. Our first speaker is a dear friend and colleague, Roberto Gonzalez, professor of education at Harvard University, author of the very well known, for people working in this field, book Lives in Limbo. Roberto has done over 40 presentations of the book in the last few months, I think. And counting, and has won 7 major awards, including the Wright Mills Award, which is a very important sociology, social policy, social problem award in the US. And it's a delight to have Roberto here. I'll stop here because we haven't got time. Otherwise, please, Roberto, you're welcome.
Well, thank you, Nando. Thanks also, thanks to Elaine, to Nando, Francesca, to Jenny, and really the whole team. This is wonderful. From the conversations that were started yesterday to the presentation today, this has been really inspiring, and I'm taking a lot of notes because I'm really appreciating the various dimensions of this Becoming Adult project. It's also a pleasure to be here through the snow and buses. And Sunday we tried to go see Thomas the Train and spent 2.5 hours in a taxi. I've got a 3.5-year-old in tow. But we love Oxford and it's great to be here with old friends. What I want to do in my time is to draw a slightly different circle, and that is to discuss the U.S. context, both immigration and policy context, that look quite different, I think, than what we've been talking about this morning. And I want to do that largely through 2 major studies that I've carried out over the last 15 years. From 2003 to about 2015, I followed 150 undocumented young adults in Los Angeles, all came before the age of 12, and then followed up that research with a national project looking at the Obama Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, a program that was recently terminated, and so we'll start there. So on September 5th of this year, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the end of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The Obama deportation relief program that shielded close to 800,000 undocumented youth and young adults. The program has been successful and popular by almost every metric, but under the Trump administration, in service to fulfilling campaign promises, using the familiar trope of quote-unquote illegal immigrants taking U.S. jobs, Sessions and the Trump administration more broadly ended this program. In ending the program, they also provided a 6-month wind-down for the U.S. Congress to act to try to provide permanent legislation. So DACA, for those of you not familiar, was an administrative program, so by nature, partial and temporary. As the clock winds down, Congress has until March 5th to act on immigration. So time is a really important element here, and I think that as throughout all of our work, as time comes up very centrally for young people, for policymakers, for families. And our lawmakers like to say that change takes time. And I think indeed if we look historically at any progressive change, it's taken years, if not decades, to accomplish. And the policymaking process is incremental, oftentimes baby steps at a time, oftentimes taking two steps backwards in order to get one forward. But these ideas don't square with the everyday realities of children and their families who are living under sometimes extreme circumstances, trying to make ends meet, trying to eke out a life, oftentimes navigating very difficult and perilous circumstances. So framing this in the U.S. is really our Congress's inability to act on immigration. So most Americans will agree that our immigration system is broken. Many people would argue it's dysfunctional, and some would argue that that's by design. But most people would say that our immigration system is in vast need of repair. People have a difference of opinion about how to do that, but nevertheless, our Congress has not been able to act. The last legalization in the U.S. was in 1986. So here we are 31 years later without a comprehensive solution to immigration. But meanwhile, what we've had as a de facto policy in the U.S., right, is massive enforcement. As my colleague Gary Segura, a political scientist at UCLA, has called enforcement on steroids. Right? So under the Obama administration, upwards of 3 million people in 8 years were removed from the United States. This reality is a reality that sows fear and anxiety, right, in the lives of young people, and with the knowledge that waiting at a bus stop, sitting at a stoop, walking through a park during daytime can land someone in detention or deportation. But meanwhile, young people and their families in the U.S. have no other choice but to wait. So just a little bit of the demographic profile here, the demographic context in the U.S. More than 16.5 million people live in a mixed status family. So largely much of the morning's discussion was on unaccompanied minors, the U.S. context, while not exclusively, is largely driven by family migration mixed status families, whereby at least one member of the household doesn't have status. About 11 million people in the U.S. Are undocumented, and while politicians and our media like to paint this population in broad brushstrokes, the reality is it's a very diverse population, and upwards of 2.5 million of that population have been here since childhood. So a very sizable segment, 16 to 20%, right, of the massive undocumented population in the U.S. has been here since childhood. So a more general scholarship on the transitions to adulthood has argued that given changes in our economy and the culture, the milestones to adulthood that we've traditionally held on to, finishing school, buying a house, getting married, starting a career, that young people are extending adolescence, right, in order to build on their human capital, in order to invest in higher education. Returns on education are now sharp. However, for many young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, right, many young people cannot avoid responsibilities that allow them, right, that would otherwise allow them to linger in adolescence, right? For undocumented young people in the U.S., the context is one rife with contradictions. So our Supreme Court ruled in 1982 that states could not deny undocumented children access to a K-12 education. Right? As a result of this decision in Plyler versus Doe, hundreds of thousands of young people have gone through our public school system. Right? Tens of thousands of undocumented children, right, undocumented youth, graduate from U.S. high schools every year. But Plyler's reach was limited. Plyler didn't address education beyond K through 12, and it didn't address life beyond school. So whereas undocumented young people have access to very important, very defining K through 12 education, right? They can't work legally, they can't travel outside of the country, they can't vote, they're not eligible for financial aid. In most states in the US, they can't get a driver's license, and they can be deported at any time, right? So our laws treat children and adults differently, but don't account for the continuity of children becoming adults, right? So in my book, Lives in Limbo, that followed 150 undocumented young people over 12 years, I argue that illegality is a master status. So two things here. My use of the I word is not as a noun. It's not to refer to people as quote unquote illegal, but to draw attention away from individuals and onto our policies and practices that narrowly circumscribe people's everyday lives. Right? And the second, this idea of master status, it's an old sociological concept that refers to a particular trait, right, that dominates or overwhelms the others. Right? So here it's the status that for many young people, regardless of their English fluency, regardless of their acculturation, regardless of their educational attainment, right, in more plain language, it's a binding constraint, a lead weight, if you will, that eventually, over time, right, eventually drags them down. So in this earlier work, I conceptualize what I term a transition to illegality, right? And that is as young people, undocumented young people who grow up alongside of American-born friends and peers, their lives in childhood look very similar to their peers, right? In lockstep fashion, they grow up to a daily pledge of allegiance to Barney and the Power Rangers. They date, they go to prom, they do everything that their peers are doing, but at a critical time, as a world of independence is opening up to their peers, right? As their peers are moving into lives of greater independence, right? These young people are hitting this cliff edge, as we talked about this morning, right? Unable to join their friends in very important defining rites of passage, right? As a result, for many of them, they experience this awakening that for many of them is like a living nightmare. Right? Their pathways in adulthood are blocked. They're blocked by their immigration status. Many of them also, as they're growing into a greater awareness of the barriers, are also moving into a greater awareness of the identity of undocumented immigrant and what that means in society, the stigma. And for many young people, keeping that their status a secret to friends, to teachers, to counselors, to even romantic partners. And what that means for them is that oftentimes that these young people are opting out, right? Opting out of activities and therefore severing ties with important friendship and other networks of support, right? And then over time, they must undergo this process of learning what it means to live the life of an undocumented immigrant in the US. And then finally, as has been mentioned before, this morning, many of these young people and almost the person, the number of the young people that I've talked to, describe physical and emotional manifestations of stress. Chronic headaches, toothaches, trouble sleeping, problems getting out of bed in the morning, thoughts of suicide, attempted suicide. It's become very clear this very strong connection between undocumented status and strained well-being. But things changed slightly in 2012 when Obama announced this DACA program. Right, a program that delayed deportation for 2 years for eligible young people, that provided work authorization. Right? Young people then became eligible for driver's licenses. Right? In the very short term, young people with this status, as I mentioned before, almost 800,000 young people took giant steps towards the American mainstream. So shortly after that, we started what was my second long-term project. A massive project. We've got a team of about 65 people In six sites. In 2013, we carried out a national survey. We surveyed about 2,700 DACA-eligible young people. And then we've done two waves of interviews, face-to-face interviews, with about 500 young people. And we're finding very strong evidence that through DACA, through increased access, that young people are experiencing a delay in this transition to illegality. All right? So for many of the young people, our survey takes place 16 months after the announcement of the program. And in almost immediately, we see giant jumps. The young people were getting new jobs, increasing their earnings, building credit through bank accounts, through credit cards, obtaining new forms of health care, driver's licenses, right? The significance of this program could not be underscored enough. Young people also told us that they were less afraid of law enforcement. They're less afraid of being deported, right? And nearly 70% of our survey respondents said they felt less stressed. Right? Again, the significance of this program cannot be underscored. Young people also were telling us that they improved their outlook. Jen from South Carolina told us that it gave me hope that my future's not up in the air anymore. Max from New York said, I finally feel like I'm part of the US, like I'm no longer living in the shadows. Jenny from Chicago said, I feel like it saved my life. So to be sure, this policy, this deferred action policy, has been arguably the most successful policy of immigrant integration in the last 30 some years in the U.S. But nevertheless, as a policy that was not through legislation but through administrative action, and a policy that only targeted a small slice of the population, many barriers remain. It did not provide a pathway to citizenship, did not provide means of relief to family members, right? And so we see is a continued family vulnerability. So while many young people had status, they continue to worry about their parents, about relatives, about loved ones. Angela from Atlanta said, I'm always scared. What if my mother gets deported out of nowhere? What if my older sister doesn't fix her status? What's going to happen with their daughters? How is my brother-in-law going to take care of things? And how is he going to be able to handle it? They're all very close. They live together. It's a lot. There's still a lot of fear in my family. So we see that overwhelmingly among our respondents who, in some ways, felt guilty about their status because their family members were not able to enjoy the same level of access. And then because of eligibility criteria, we met many young people who looked very similar to the young people that we interviewed who had status, but fell out of eligibility because they came, in some cases, days later, right? Or because they had aged out of eligibility. And so as protections for these young people increased, young people who were not able to obtain this status fell further and further behind. And so here's Eddie from Phoenix. He says, I try not to think about deportation. When it does happen, like say I'm driving fine. Driving the speed limit, hands on the wheel, 10 and 2. Then I see a cop behind me. I think, was I speeding? Was I going 5 above the speed limit? Did I turn? When I turned, did I use the signal right? Is he looking at me? Is he looking at my skin? I think, am I going to get deported if I get stopped? Am I going to jail and then get deported? If I do get deported, am I going to get deported to where I live or where I used to live? Or are they going to send me far away? They're going to be like, oh, he lives over here. Let's send him over there. If he does stop me, is he going to take my card away? Where is he going to go? My mom, how are they going to get help? All of this goes through my head. It affects me mentally, physically, and emotionally. Every time I read this quote, I get stressed out. But this is a lot for young people to be contending with, to be worrying about on a day-to-day basis, sometimes several flashpoints during the day of worry. And then finally, as young people and their families are well aware of now, that this is a program, again, that provided partial and temporary access, right? A status that could be revoked like that, and it has. Right, it has with the Trump administration. A couple of years ago, through a glitch in the system that processes these renewal applications, several hundred of these young people fell out of status And as a result, they had to leave their places of work. Their lives then went, they were cast back in limbo, their lives on hold again. Right? And here's Lee from Phoenix. He said, I don't know, I did what I was supposed to do. It really put me right back where I was. It was that slap in the face reminder that I'm still undocumented. I'm still vulnerable. I could be arrested and deported like that. It really brought me down. So this sense of fragility, and that for 5 years, many young people who had experienced this status, right, is what they confront on March 5th, right? If the U.S. Congress does not act on March 5th to provide some sort of pathway for these young people, 1,000 young people every day will lose their status over the next 2 years. Right, 1,000 young people a day. We think about this program, 800,000 is no marginal number. This is the size of a mid-sized U.S. cities: Boston, Seattle, Baltimore, Atlanta. And so. Perfect. And so moving forward, these really critical questions for policymakers, but also for scholars and practitioners, is where do we go from here, right? If there's no legislative fix, right, and for these young people, the policy debate often takes place at the 30,000 foot level, and many of us feel powerless to address federal legislation. But how do we think about those everyday lives that young people and their families lead? And how, as teachers, counselors, social workers, public health professionals, right, police districts, chambers of commerce, how can local institutions and local actors address those everyday needs, right, in light of a legislative solution? Thank you very much.
We move in the second presentation by Professor Sine Smith-Jevelud. Sine is Associate Professor at the Department of Public Health at the University of Copenhagen and Director of the Danish Research Center for Migration, Ethnicity and Health.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I just find the slide. Well, first of all, thank you so much for welcoming here today. Thank you so much for inviting me. I've been so excited to be here, especially thanks to Julia and to Elaine. And also thank you for all the inputs and inspiration that this project and all the other presentations have given me. I'm very touched by the stories, and I'm coming home more enlightened than when I came. So thank you so much for that. I'm here to present Coming of Age in Exile, also called CAGE. And focusing on the health, education, and employment outcomes for young refugees in the Nordic countries, which is a project that I am co-leading. So when talking about immigrants and refugees and their health and settlement, I think it's very important to understand it in the light of the societal discourses. So I think these two pictures kind of present the setting or the scene in their Scandinavian countries quite well. So the one on the left is a picture from Denmark from 1956, greeting Hungarian refugees with warm coffee and pastries. Whereas on the right picture, it is taken in August 2015, and you see an ethnic Danish man spitting on Syrian refugees walking on their motorway or on motorway on their way to seek asylum, not in Denmark, but in Sweden. So I know this is a very extreme way to put it, but I think you get the picture. So the background of the project is that we see an increasing immigration to the Nordic countries. And since 1970s, we have seen an increasing proportion of refugees. Of the refugees, 20 to 30% are children below the age of 18, an increasing proportion of them are unaccompanied minors. And many of our refugees live in neighborhoods that are characterized by social disadvantage and also high ethnic minority density. So why have we chosen a Nordic approach and not a more, you say, European approach? Well, in the Nordic countries here, represented by Finland, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, we have major similarities. We have many similarities regarding the majority populations in the countries, and we have welfare societies as well. We also face major differences, mostly regarding the immigration patterns, where people settle and where they come from, but also in particular different immigration and refugee policies. And then we have quite unique registry data in the Nordic countries that can be compared, and they are nationwide, and we also have a close research collaboration. So equity in health is one of the fundamental values of the Scandinavian welfare societies, and it's also one of the major or the underlying values of the CAGE project. So the aims of the project is to investigate how socioeconomic and health inequalities develop during the formative years in young refugees, and to investigate how socioeconomic status and health are interrelated and associated with the key areas of welfare policy like education, health, and employment, and to identify welfare policies that may promote health and socioeconomic equity in young refugees comparing with the majority population. So this project started 1.5 years ago and will end in 2 years from now. And we have 5 partners, 1 in Denmark, 1 in Finland, 2 in Norway, and 1 in Sweden. And it's funded by Norfolk with a grant of 30 million Norwegian crowns, which is equivalent to 2.7 million pounds. So looking into the mental health of the refugees, young refugees in the Nordic countries, we see overall a much poorer health, which is not surprising to any of you, I know. Looking into depression, we have found that refugees have a much higher prevalence of depression compared to their native-born peers. And factors that are associated with more depression in refugees are traumatic pre-migration experiences, discrimination, and daily hassles in the host country. And factors that are associated with less depression is social support, greater host language proficiency, and higher educational attainment. And these are for refugees who have legal status. Zooming in on emotional and behavioral problems, we see different reaction patterns in females and males. Females being more internalizing problems, where males are more externalizing problems or symptoms. Findings from a longitudinal study showed that the social context in the host country were more important to their mental health and their symptoms than pre-migration experiences such as traumatization. More problems in regards to emotional and behavioral problems were associated with traumatic pre-migration experiences, but also discrimination, school relocation, and stressful post-migration experiences. People or refugees with less problems and factors associated hereof were attending school or being employed, having ethnic majority friends, having a greater host language proficiency, and having parents with a longer education. For psychiatric disorders, we saw the same overall rate ratio among refugees as well as or compared to ethnic minority peers. But refugees had a higher rate ratio for psychotic and nervous disorders, but a lower risk for affective disorders compared to the native peers. And what was associated with psychiatric disorders were being a quota refugee, being unaccompanied, having a lower household income, and having an older age when you obtain your residence permission. When we look into education, We saw that accompanied refugees were enrolled in education to a greater extent than the general population. But unaccompanied refugees were enrolled in education twice as often as unaccompanied refugees. When looking into the school achievement, and this is from a study in Finland, we see that Vietnamese refugees had a lower grade point average than the native-born peers, and discrimination and what the authors have called adherence to traditional Vietnamese family values, what is that is, it is associated with poor achievement. And finally, better host language proficiency were also associated with better achievements. When looking into educational attainment, and we saw among unaccompanied minors in Sweden that very few of them have undergone post-secondary education, and more females than males completed upper secondary school. And being younger than 15 years of arrival in the Scandinavian countries, you were at a higher chance of completing upper secondary school than if you arrived at an older age, such as being 16 or 18, or 16 or 17, sorry. And for Finland, looking into Vietnamese refugees, they saw that what was associated with having more than a compulsory education was less discrimination in childhood, and also greater host country language proficiency, adherence to what the authors call Finnish values, and ethnic self-identification as Vietnamese. For employment, refugees were employed to a lesser extent than the general population. Also, when you divide it into immigrants, their descendants, and native-born. About 50% of refugees, young refugees, were employed, and more men than women were employed. And unaccompanied refugees were employed to a greater extent than unaccompanied refugees. And more than primary education improved your probability of being employed. And unfortunately, the employment or were only mostly in unskilled jobs for the refugees. So these studies have not, very few studies have looked into the links between health, education, and employment. And that is what we are trying to aim as well with the CAGE project. We see, however, that that it suggests some kind of interrelatedness of mental health, employment, and educational outcomes. We see that higher education attainment are associated with less depression. We also see that long-term improvements in mental health are associated with studying or working. And education had a positive effect on employment probability. And also some of the refugees are outside the labor force and receive some kind of health-related subsidies, indicating that they're too ill to work. So I think these studies, or this study, show that there is a need for further longitudinal studies would look into the causal and interrelated effects of health and education and employment. And then in order to shed light of this, and also to get shed light of the effects of policies on these outcomes, it is important to have comparative research, either international comparative research or Nordic comparative research. One of my PhD students, he looked into NEET status, and NEET status means not in education, employment, or training. And the NEET status is a great predictor of later adverse outcomes in health, education, and employment later in life. And the pointer. Yes. So this shows, I'll stand over here so you can hear me, youth at the age of 22. And we have refugees here, and we have other immigrants, this dotted line, and then we have, so children born in Denmark to parents who are not born in Denmark, that is the group A, and then we have children born in Denmark to, of whom at least one parent is born in Denmark, and that is the group B. So what you see here, and having this, using registered data for the whole population, so it's about 1.5 million people in this analysis, we see that for the whole group, the NEET status is a remarkable reducing from 25% being in NEET status till about 7% among the refugees. For the other groups, especially also immigrants, is falling, right, while the other groups are quietly steady. So a very positive picture. Zooming in the differences between where people are from, so looking into the country of origin. And here you see Afghanistan, ex-Yugoslavia, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, mainly Palestinians, and Somalia. We see a similar pattern. So you see a different degree of being in need status, but all have a negative slope. And the size of the circle means the number, represent the number of people who came at that specific time. So for all different refugee groups, we see a declining picture when it comes to need status. So in conclusion, I think our study points to that discrimination, host language proficiency, support from social networks are important factors for young refugees' well-being and integration into societies. And these factors are related to factors that the host country can control. And also that welfare policies can address these factors. So I think also the findings from Denmark are showing that we see narrowing the gap between refugees and the rest of the population. And then I put a question mark whether we are moving in the right direction when Denmark are offering refugees with stricter and stricter conditions and meeting them with attitudes that are becoming more antagonized. So I will just end with saying that this picture is also from August 2015. And it's showing, again, the Syrian refugees walking on the motorway to seek asylum in Sweden. And we cannot prevent future situations like this, what happened, but we can provide scientific evidence on welfare policies that may promote health and socioeconomic equity in young refugees compared with the majority population in the long run, and that will promote social integration and also sustainable welfare institutions and systems, and that will be through collaboration. And finally, this is just a slide for the participating research teams. Thank you so much for your attention.
Our first speaker is Ada Ellis-Tibbett from the University of Bern, and Ada is a PhD student in social anthropology, and this presentation is part of her PhD work on transnational biographies of education.
How long do we talk?
20 minutes.
I couldn't print out my paper, so I hope it doesn't fall. No, I keep it like this. Sorry. How do I put it on this one?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so I kind of changed my title a little bit because I decided to share you a bit more of a broader picture, and that's my name of my PhD, Learning, Agency and Freedom among the Unaccompanied Asylum Seeking Youth in Turkey. And the way you're looking at the snowy playfield is actually a photograph made by a Somali participant who later on became the co-researcher and the co-ethnographer. So basically, I now would like to take you to a journey through his photographs he made. And he called this one Fenced Playground. This is our research website, TransEduscapes. It's in the University of Bern and in collaboration with the Pädagogische Hochschule, which is the pedagogic institute in Bern. And this is from our international workshop where Elaine Chase and Francesca Meloni was participating too. That's how we met, and thank you very much for also inviting me here today. These are some of our publications. I'll be presenting my findings aligned to my publications so people don't call me just an activist who can't, you know, come up with theories and concepts. I think it's possible to do both. All right, after the show off. Okay. Accessing the field at times of solidarity. You see us sitting in front of, it's the neighborhood called Yaldirmeni in Kadıköy, Istanbul. This is the first time we had a solidarity food dining together with the unaccompanied minors who are actually residing there in an institution. It's a state care protection institution called CHOGEM. the English conversion to that would be a child and youth support center, but we call it a shelter. But obviously it's a shelter, but it's a place of many other things which we will be discovering. This is a times of solidarity because this is much before Merkel closed her borders. She was welcoming refugees. It's exactly that time, October 2015, which is very ironically, a year later it would be a much different aura that was being experienced also in Turkey, which I will be talking about. This is Abdi, the co-researcher, Abdi Deg. He's from Somalia. He was 17 years old when he started making these photographs. Now he's 18. But before we come to what is happening with him now, I'd like to give a bit of an idea of how we carried on with our method. Well, I followed a lot of, I was really inspired by Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And our first class was really about us trying to find teams on how we wanted to carry on working together. And so basically, I proposed to the State Care Institution a radio program where we could keep it in a very dialogical stance. But then during the radio show, something incredible was happening. And that is what I defined it through the help of Homi Baba, which we've seen the emergence of a third space. The relation to the other is to take the risk, to take the unconscious of the other, to recognize, to risk identifying with the untranslatable, to take the risk of the displacement of the angle of the vision. And we kept finding ourselves in this very interesting angle of vision where we were not really able to anymore define our roles. Who was the researcher? Who was the researched? And what was really going on? And then Abdi said, you know, actually I like your idea of radio show, but I'd also like to take photographs. And this is when, instead of actually giving a really crappy camera, I found him a really good camera. Because I thought it would be amazing that we could also use these photographs in exhibitions and so on. So we could give him a DSLR. And so somehow we tried to connect to the idea of the mirror, the emergence of a third space where you could see this displaced angle of vision. And that comes with actually eradicating this barrier between the researcher and the research. So that was our first goal. The next thing, again, the mirror effect, dialogical sites, which I just talked about. And this is the shelter, in which throughout the time together, we've seen how actually miners kept describing it as a crossroad, a border, a station, a school, home, and even a prison. A place where all these things could be experienced. And that was very interesting to see how, according to also different nationalities and backgrounds. So because our study is about navigating educational pathways, it's not only about the formal educational setting, but it's actually about informing learning that could take place throughout the journey these young people are taking. And according to Abdi, when he made this photograph, which we keep carrying on doing photography at the stations, we talk about these photographs as he makes them, we talk them in the radio shows as well, he comes and says, you know, if there's no education, there's no safety. Many of my Afghan brothers are working in the construction sites here in Istanbul. They did the same back in Iran or also in Pakistan, I heard. If you don't get education, this is the only option for you. And as you can see from this photograph, this man works without a helmet. He's on the top floor, and the wooden structure that he stands on looks very fragile. It's also interesting, you see, it looks as if there is a cross on him. It is as if giving us a message, don't work this way, you're not safe. So for Abdi, it was clear that what unaccompanied minors were first learning about was learning about their boundaries and their barriers. They were learning how to behave according to all the control mechanisms that were inflicted on them by various state agents. That could be, who are these state agents? The people who are also running the state care facility that is run by the Social and Policy Family Ministry. but also by volunteers and teachers that are also somehow forming what we see as the state. So it's not necessarily the bureaucrats that you think of as the state, but it's actually all of us that become the state. And then he called this photograph Catastrophe on the Sea. And again, thinking of Baba, the realm of conscious and unconscious process in which a displacement of the angle of the vision is the difference between life, death, and survival. So actually what we kept trying to understand throughout our talks together with the miners in the radio shows and in our photography at the stations, we were actually trying to look for ways to survive. What would happen? Should I stay or should I leave? Should I go to Europe or should I remain in Turkey? What is it that gives you this decision to where you stay or how you continue? And another reason why a lot of people do not remain in Turkey is because Turkey doesn't really have an effective refugee policy, not until 2014, which is again very much EU-based. And then we have two different protection frameworks.